questions that comes up every year on Red Wednesday, which is still relatively new, is why is the priest not wearing red? And the reason for that is the liturgical color of the day is green. Even though the bishops have encouraged churches to shine red lights on the facades of their churches and to use red to indicate the Red Wednesday and encouraged all mass goers to wear red today. A couple of people have actually worn red. I don't know if that's deliberate or accidental. But anyway, so, but that advice about wearing red, it doesn't apply to the liturgical ministers. Although I won't be surprised if many priests wear red today, because it says in the Ordo, here it is, Wednesday, 34th week, ordinary time, it says in green, then it says Red Wednesday. So if you don't look closely, it looks like red is the color of the day. Anyway, it is Red Wednesday, and this is a day to express our solidarity with our persecuted brothers and sisters, to show that we have not forgotten them, to show that we are concerned about the injustice being committed against them, and more important than wearing red, of course, is to pray for them. That's why we're using the mass for persecuted Christians today. And with the church, especially the church here in the Philippines, we're praying for the millions of our brothers and sisters who are persecuted because they are Christians. In the news most recently, there's been more abductions of school children in Nigeria. You probably saw that in the news. I don't know if they were abducted because they were Christians, maybe. There's a lot of breakdown of social order there, as we know. But there have been abductions of priests, religious. There have been attacks on churches, parishes, seminaries. So, but that's not only in Nigeria, but in many, many places. As disturbing as this is, it's actually no surprise that there is persecution of Christians, because Jesus said many times that this would happen. Today's gospel is one example. In fact, today's gospel is the reason why Red Wednesday lands on this day, because of this gospel in which Jesus says, this is what will happen. They will seize and persecute you. They will hand you over to the synagogues and to prisons, and they will have you led before kings and governors because of my name. So, as I say, this is not the only place where Jesus speaks about this, but this is one of the clearest declarations that part of being a Christian is and will be persecution for being a Christian. This gospel today is a continuation from yesterday, in which Jesus spoke about the destruction of the temple, not one stone left on a stone, and about the calamities that will plague the world, both natural disasters and conflicts, wars. If that weren't bad enough, he continues in today's gospel talking about persecution, not only persecution by authorities, but persecution even by family members, even parents, brothers, relatives, and friends. We might say, well, what is Jesus trying to do here, talking about all this negativity? Is he trying to discourage us? Is he trying to frighten us? Is he trying to intimidate us? No. He's trying to prepare us. This is simply the reality, and he wants us to know it. So he doesn't want us to be frightened. In fact, quite the opposite. He wants us to be at peace with the knowledge that this is the way it goes. He even speaks about the fruit of this terrible news. This will lead to your giving testimony. In other words, when Christians are persecuted, it has the effect of also spreading the gospel. And this is true in every age of the church's history. And then at the end of today's gospel, he says, by your perseverance, you will secure your lives. So persecution, as terrible as it is, even martyrdom, is not defeat. It's a way to practice perseverance and to win the victory. So we pray for our persecuted brothers and sisters. We pray that they persevere We pray that they be strong. Yes, we also pray that the persecution end, because it is unjust, and in the worst possible way. But if it doesn't, we pray that our brothers and sisters will persevere and gain the crown that comes with perseverance. So that's part of Red Wednesday. In the first reading, we continue reading from the mysterious book of the prophet Daniel. And here we have another passage which has given rise to an English idiom. Yesterday, I spoke about the idiom that came from the story about the great statue, and that is the idiom of someone or some group having feet of clay. The idiom that comes from today's, the English idiom that comes from today's reading is the writing on the wall, or see the writing on the wall, or read the writing on the wall. Anything to do with writing on the wall in English comes from this passage, because King Belshazzar and everybody else at the banquet saw a hand writing three words on the wall of the palace. A very strange vision, quite a striking one. And so that idiom, read the writing on the wall, or see the writing on the wall, it means see that there's evidence that a disaster is imminent. See the sign that something, it's the clear sign that something terrible is going to happen to you. So don't be ignorant of what is to come. That's kind of how the idiom is used. So if someone says to a politician, you see the writing on the wall, he's saying, you're going to be defeated, something like that. Now let's reflect a little bit about King Belshazzar. He's, of course, the son of, or in some accounts, he's the grandson. But anyway, he's a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, who in yesterday's reading was proclaimed as the King of Kings, the head of gold. So Belshazzar is maybe the silver, arms and chest of silver in the statue we saw yesterday. So here he is having a great banquet and drinking, which in itself is not necessarily a bad thing. But he takes the next step when he deliberately chooses to pull in the sacred vessels which had been stolen from the Jews, the gold and silver vessels which had been taken from the temple in Jerusalem, and he decides, let's use these great vessels for our party. His intention, I'm sure, is to impress and to enjoy and to make festivity, and perhaps also to mock the defeated people, the peoples of Judah. But it backfires because he steps over the line from legitimate festivity, if that's what it was. I mean, he's a pagan, so who knows. But steps over the line from what could be okay, because a banquet is not in itself a bad thing, to the deliberate offense against God and against his people. What came to mind when I read this again was an article I ran across recently about a scholar who was dealing with, or he was trying to do God's will and he was miserable. So he said he looked up on Google how to be happy, and he ran across a whole bunch of research on what's now called positive psychology. Positive psychology. So psychology and psychiatry typically are directed toward disorders, right? Depression, mental illness, you know, neuroses of different kinds, and healing or treating the sicknesses. And according to positive psychology, the idea is, well, that's not good enough to simply focus on the negative all the time. Let's focus on happiness and try to foster happiness. And so the science has identified various aspects or characteristics of what we call happiness. It's not that easy to measure, but that's what they try to do. So one of them is positive emotions, good relationships, material security, experience of achievement, things like this. And so they did an experiment, the psychiatrists did an experiment. They took a bunch of college students and divided them into two groups. And they want to measure their happiness and what gives them greater happiness. So one group was told, okay, here's some money, spend the weekend enjoying yourself. Eat ice cream, go to the movies, go to the amusement park, have fun. The other group was given some money and said, now go and serve some people in need. Go to the orphanages, the hospitals, prisons, or do something to bring happiness to others. So these two groups went out and did their thing, and then they came back together and they measured. Both groups had a very high measure of positive emotion. They're happy. But the first group, that happiness diminished very quickly. They were happy when they had when they were riding the roller coaster, but the next day that happiness was gone. But the second group that had done good for others, they had a level of happiness that lasted long past the actual activity. Even a week later, they had higher levels of happiness. Now, that's a secular study, and it doesn't surprise any Christian because love of others is a very fulfilling way to live, and self-indulgence is not. Now, the reason I bring this up is because here's King Belshazzar pursuing happiness by self-indulgence. And it seems that this is his whole way of life. It's not just this night when he had a banquet, or just this time when he desecrated the sacred vessels. No, he is a man who is lacking. And that's what the words written on the wall tell him. God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. You have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. What's lacking? Love. Love of others, love of God and love of others. And then the third word, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So what is on display there is King Belshazzar's fatal mistake is to indulge himself, to make himself the standard by which his happiness will grow. Even to the point where he will use God and things of God for himself. Now, we might say to ourselves, well, we're not like King Belshazzar, we don't have that kind of opportunity, and we don't have that kind of power, and what are we supposed to learn from this? No, it's not that difficult to try to use things of God, or try to force God into being the servant of our selfish happiness, selfish measure of happiness. It's not that uncommon. In fact, every sin is, in a sense, the sin of Belshazzar. Every sin is to say, I'm going to do it my way, and I want God to bless my decision. Every sin is a decision not to do the will of God. So in that sense, everybody's a Belshazzar whenever we sin. What's the answer? Not to be like that. Not to be like that. That's why persecution, as terrible as it is, has a good effect on Christians, and this is perhaps one of the reasons why God keeps allowing it for century after century. Why does he allow his beloved people to suffer? Well, they actually benefit from it if they persevere. By perseverance, you will secure your life. So God does allow into our lives not only persecution, but many different sources of suffering. Not because he's against us, but because he doesn't want us to fall into the sin of Belshazzar, or the trap of Belshazzar, or the lie that we'll be happier if we serve ourselves. No. Well, maybe for a few minutes we will be. As long as we still have ice cream, we're happy. But that's not going to give us lasting happiness. And God knows that, and we don't, or we tend to forget. So God is at work in giving us happiness, yes. Lasting happiness. In fact, eternal joy, eternal glory. That's what we celebrate. We celebrate this week in the week of Christ the King. Not only that Christ is the King, there's no doubt about that, but that we can reign with him. And that's what we long for. So let us not fall into the trap of Belshazzar or the trap of thinking that God is against us when things go wrong. No. With strong faith, with inspiration from those who have gone ahead of us and have persevered, let us also persevere and thereby secure our lives.